cliffcentral.com.
Professor Cheryl Del Rey, the Vice-Chancellor and Rector of the University of Pretoria, one of the most eminent tertiary education institutions in South Africa, a place with a long history, a place that I've got some history with, and a place that has churned out some of our most formidable minds in various disciplines, the sciences, engineering, the arts. It's really an incredible university. But we're not here really to talk just about that, because South Africa is a place where, you know, you blink your eyes and everything's changed. And in the last year and a half, 2 years, so much has happened on campuses that I thought it would be a great idea to have Prof. Del Rey in to talk to her about how they have handled all these seismic changes in tertiary education on her campus, and how much really has changed on the ground for the students, for the academics, and for the kind of work that they do at the university that will hopefully stand for a very, very long time. So, Prof, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the invitation.
No, it's delightful. I'm thrilled that we could have, you know, conversations with someone who's as busy as you are, particularly in January.
Oh, you're most welcome. It is a busy time, but it's what I call good busy. It's filled with a sense of anticipation about the year ahead. Lots of new first-year students, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, so to speak. So I enjoy this time of the year.
Now, can we start off with all the people who have applied? Because I heard a report the other day about tens of thousands of people and applying to every single university, hundreds of thousands even. And I suddenly got very, very nervous, because I thought, here are all these people who are not going to find places in the universities just because there isn't capacity, first of all. And second of all, do we need that many university qualified professionals in a country where we're crying out for people in other disciplines to make themselves available or to start their own businesses? How are the numbers squaring up, first of all, for the University of Pretoria? And can you please shed some light for us on what those numbers mean when you actually drill down into the statistics?
Right. Firstly, let's look at what the numbers mean more broadly. We are, as a country, producing a growing number of qualifiers or matriculants every year, which is a good sign. It means that more of our young people are finishing school completely rather than exiting school at an earlier grade. The other positive is, I think, for a country like ours, a young democracy, an economy that should be growing a lot faster, is that there is a sense of ambition about the future in the youth. They want a university education, and they're aspirational. Very positive for us.
Mm.
I think the challenge for us is to create more pathways for young, ambitious people. By more pathways, I mean a diversity of options. So looking at technically qualified people, of which there's a huge shortage in South Africa, artisans, for example, in many cases on big projects that we've completed or undertaking in the infrastructure, energy domain, we've been relying on imported skills.
Mm.
If we look at the Gautrain project that was completed some years ago, we didn't have enough local skills. I'm broadly talking about artisans. There's some very highly specialized areas where we must encourage bright young people to go into. So I think we need to get a strong message out there about a diversity of career pathways, and to make sure that the offering is at the right level of quality and relevance for what's required in the economy.
Well, I mean, just before you even get to the other numbers, people are saying that the kinds of jobs that we will need 4 years, 5 years from now are the kind of jobs that we don't even know to name now.
That's quite true. And it's changing a lot more rapidly than ever before in human history. If we look at, you know, the impact of artificial intelligence and the associated technology, it's clearly changing our lives in major ways. But I think there are a set of important, shall I say, timeless skills that universities are well placed to foster. And some of those skills are fostering a sense of understanding the world and how the world is changing, a sense of problem solving and your ability to solve problems, a sense of innovation, or a spirit of innovation and entrepreneurship, and the skills to navigate this very complex society. And that's what universities are well-placed to do. And those are timeless skills. Certainly as the world changes, communication, emotional intelligence, and those sorts of what people sometimes call softer skills are really important. And we as a university have been paying increasing attention to the question of relevance. It's one of our principles, thinking about how is the world changing. And we speak to our industry partners. And the kind of question I ask them is, tell me how you see your industry in 10 years' time. You know, we've got the largest engineering school in the country. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to the automotive industry, you know, the sense that driverless cars, I mean, the technology is basically there. It's going to be a reality in the future. The use of robotics in the mining sector. Yeah. And we have to prepare our graduates for that. I mean, I can just look at how the world has changed since you graduated from Tux FM.
Yeah, you know.
Your whole medium has shifted.
Absolutely. And nothing that we learnt in radio then applies in terms of the technology.
Yeah.
But as you say, the soft skills, the ability to storytell, to have conversations, those are things that are innately human and can be refined for the purposes of productivity and economic gain and employment in ways that perhaps we haven't up to now given as much attention. You know, post the Industrial Revolution, I suppose everybody was interested in empirical knowledge.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned the Industrial Revolution. We certainly can look back at human history, and there are periods where change is intense, intensified. That was one, you know, the use of machinery to change manufacturing fundamentally. And now we're seeing perhaps another one of those periods where the services, or the so-called services industry, has become far more important than ever before in human history. You know, we've just revolutionized the whole area of cooking.
Yeah.
If you look at the phenomenal growth in colloquially I would describe as cooking shows.
I go into bookstores these days. I don't know about you. Are you a whiz in the kitchen?
I won't say I'm a whiz, but I'm certainly a whiz at watching cooking shows.
Okay, so you do watch those shows.
Yeah, I do watch those shows.
Do you buy it? Because I go into bookstores.
And eating, of course.
Sure, there I'm with you. But I go into bookstores now, and you will struggle to find a section on history or biographies by comparison with the section on cooking and religion.
Yeah, because our lifestyle has changed.
And everybody's a celebrity chef now.
Yeah, or wants to be.
But, you know, more power to those people. They've found a niche and they're exploiting it and they're doing very well.
But also, just to go back to that, let's take something that you might think is just a technical skill. If we look at trends in cooking, understanding the science of cooking has become much more important because it's really about innovation in the kitchen. And that innovation rests on understanding the chemical processes that change a product like...
Well, this is what Heston Blumenthal's meant to have been the kind of high priest of, is this idea that actually if we do it on an organic chemical level, we can figure out what caramelization occurs in sugars and these kinds of things. And we can actually do the chemical equations that before were reserved for the laboratory.
Absolutely. And, you know, we offer BSc and many of our graduates have done extremely well in consumer sciences. But it may sound that only appeals to a certain part of the population. But that set of knowledge goes right from food production, which is fundamentally one of the priorities for Africa. It's about food security.
Sure.
How do we produce food more efficiently? How do we deal with the impact of climate change to what goes on in the kitchen? So there's a whole value chain that is important to understand from a scientific base.
When you were at university for the first time, when you first went to study, would there ever have in your mind been a subject like consumer or commercial food production. I mean, it would have been unthinkable then.
No, I remember something called home economics, but it was meant to be...
That was what they made the girls do when the boys did woodwork.
Exactly. And so that, you know, we'd be better wives,
yes,
ultimately.
So that you would know to prepare something hot for your husband when he came home. Yeah. How ridiculous now.
That was the idea.
But it is quite something. Can I just for a moment digress and say that there haven't been in the long history of universities in this country a lot of women in charge of universities?
No, that's correct. I'm the first one at the University of Pretoria.
And that's a big deal. Not because we care about identity politics, but because there's a different perspective that's brought in by a woman in charge, and you're able to effect change, which will have a very different effect on the kinds of things that the university might offer to girls that before weren't considered just because there were always guys in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think it's important that we have some kind of representation at the high levels of vice chancellors and rectors. And while we have great minds in all our universities, there maybe isn't enough of that representation at the high levels.
I can't agree more. Firstly, you know, just from a, let's say from the perspective of skills and the economy, women are about 52% of our total population. So if we think about the available pool of talent, surely you can't ignore 52% of
and
the population.
And let's also remember that in many situations, the women are actually the breadwinners. The women are in single parent households.
More and more.
And they're forced to be the everything to their children, to the community.
Yes, but from a whole, you know, there are multiple reasons why we must address that. Not only from bringing a different perspective, but from, as I said, you know, let's use the available talent pool that we have in the country. So, yes, much more needs to be done to make sure we have women or a more balanced representation across the range from not only in our universities, but in the boardrooms and the like.
All right. So let's go back to the beginning, because there are all these people applying for university positions. Some are immediately disqualified because they don't have the requisite marks in matric.
Correct.
So that already counts out a large number of that terrifying figure of people who've applied.
That's correct.
Now, of the people who remain, which is still substantial, many of these people will just not get places because there isn't capacity.
That's correct.
If we try to create more capacity without necessarily having the resources to do so, we lower the quality of the education that all of those people will be receiving. So it's a difficult balancing act for you and for the other university vice chancellors to figure how much they can give and how much they can take.
It is, but, you know, we have an opportunity to really reimagine how we deliver university education with the use or the availability of online learning technologies. And that's something we are going to be focusing on more than ever before. It's firstly about access, making our offerings more accessible, but very importantly, to make sure that we also meet a need for continuing professional development. Just to go back to our earlier conversation about how the world is changing, you cannot assume, like maybe, I don't know, 50 years ago, now I have my Bachelor of Engineering, I'm qualified for life.
No.
You constantly have to re-engineer your skills base to be relevant in your profession. But also many more people change professions many times,
yeah.
4 or 5 times.
These days it's unheard of that someone will stay in the same job, even in the same career path.
Until pension age.
Correct.
So there are a variety of needs. Now, if we go back to the history of the University of Pretoria, in the early days, there was an offering after 5. I think in Afrikaans, they might have referred to Tiks na 5.
I remember that.
Yes.
There were a lot of older people who went to those.
Exactly.
Because they wanted to improve their formal education, even though they'd perhaps been in a certain job and been doing certain things to make a living in between. I remember
yes.
those classes. Yeah.
And that stopped. But now you don't have to come to the university to get that qualification. So it's something we're going to be exploring. We offer a number of short courses online already, but we'll be looking at offering our degrees online. Now, we've done quite a lot of research as well, because you mentioned quality. Now, certainly, if we increase the number of students without increasing the number of qualified academic staff and the facilities, quality will drop. But if we are able to do this by online means, the available research shows that you can have online education at an equivalent quality level to your face-to-face or traditional contact.
Sure, then it becomes sustainable.
Yes, but I also want to point out something else, that learning technology has changed the way we deliver what you might call the traditional model of contact education. So as a young student, you now come into the university knowing Google, whatever is available, and you're certainly not going to sit through a 45-minute to 50-minute lecture listening to a lecturer who simply gives you what's easily
already
available. So it's changed. We've had to rethink what we do in the classroom and how we use face-to-face. And so when you come to the class, sometimes a lecturer will expect you to have gone through the textbook material. So you come there and it's much more interactive. So it's changing the traditional model of delivery in what were called residential universities in the past. One could say there's a revolution in learning in traditional universities.
And like in so many other areas where the internet has impacted positively, it reduces the cost to the student too. Essentially, if you want to access material that before you would have had to buy in the form of textbooks or have to go to the library to get, you can now find online, largely. I mean, it depends.
Yes, you can. And certainly the library that you may remember is no longer used for books. It's used as a kind of place to learn and study, because you can access most of the material remotely.
Correct.
But speaking of cost, the key issue for South Africa is the cost of data.
Yeah, well, we're fighting that just as hard as you are.
Yeah, so that will be a game changer.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's a bit more contentious when it comes to universities, because in some ways universities have always been the territory, the most fertile territory for revolution.
We look at the history of universities, that's certainly the case.
You know, it was middle-class university-educated Frenchmen who started that revolution. It was the fathers of the Enlightenment who were also university-educated who inspired the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And in every other revolution since then, most of the important conversations and the seeds that have been planted around, you know, Marxism, socialism, communism, fascism, all of these things came out of universities.
That's correct.
You've got people who are young, who are provocative, they've got energy, they are full of idealism and ideology, sometimes the right ones, sometimes the wrong ones, depending on what position you take on these things. Yet at the same time, they are still discovering themselves. So
agreed.
In some ways, they're very susceptible to a romantic idea.
Mm-hmm.
This is a difficult thing to manage if you're in the position that you're in, because you want to treat them like adults who absolutely have a worthy opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But in many ways, that opinion is still fluid. It hasn't yet crystallized into a proper, well-thought-through position on some things.
Well, firstly, let me say, I agree with you 100% that universities throughout their history have been sites of political debate, contestation, young people producing new ideas about society and the world in general. And that's what universities are about. And I wouldn't wish it to be otherwise. It's also a time in most students' lives where they face a very complex transition from late adolescence into adulthood. And any of us can think back to that time.
I was a moron. I remember very clearly. I was a complete moron.
And it's wonderfully exciting, but also a time where you're finding your values are tested. Actually, the values you grew up with, and you have to find your own identity and it takes shape. But I think if I look back at the events of last year, there was a boundary or a principle that I think is very important that was transgressed. And the issue was this, you know, when does political protest exceed the boundary of peaceful protest? And how do we manage a university space where each person can exercise their right to free expression, where we can have robust intellectual debate without anybody feeling threatened from a safety point of view? And that's the boundary that we saw transgressed last year across the university sector. We also had a situation where there was a public concern about the 2016 academic year and the impact this would have for the country as a whole. Could we start the 2017 year on time? What would happen to those hundreds of thousands of aspirant matriculants? So that's when my level of concern really increased. It wasn't about the earlier debates that preceded that, about, you know, in our case, language policy or broader transformation issues, which are fundamentally important.
And which can be addressed, but need to be done in a sober fashion.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we use the adjective, let's say, sober, I'm really talking about at the level of, let's say, debate. Certainly, I must listen to arguments which are sometimes difficult to listen to, arguments that sometimes feel very much like personal attacks. But that's what I signed up for. But as I said, I think there was a fundamental line that was crossed last year, and that to me is totally unacceptable.
Your university dealt with things in a different way to some. You decided that there would be personal responsibility and accountability for the leaders who had led people into destructive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You made it clear that there would be consequences for those people. And largely as a result, your campus returned to a semblance of peace far quicker than the others did.
Well, you know, 2016, as I look back, was a year where I had to think about what principles do I subscribe to, not only as a leader of a university, but as a South African citizen. And let me say, I was a student of the 1980s. I was a university student, and those were rough years.
Were you politically active when you were a student?
I was never in the leadership, but I certainly participated in protests and boycotts. I remember being on campuses, and the police forces in those years used purple dye in the water cannons.
So they could find you afterwards.
So I've come through that period. So.
You know, there is, and you bring this up, so forgive me for interrupting you, but there's such a lack of appreciation for that history now, because everything is post-struggle, and everything that's pre-struggle is very binary to people.
Yes.
And it's very difficult for a protester in the Fees Must Fall movement now to give cognizance to the fact that in the 1980s, there were a lot of South Africans of many races who were as passionate about bringing down that regime from the university side of things, from even in academia, who put their lives on the line and who joined protests, who put their own academic futures on the line for what they believed in then.
Absolutely. You know, you referred to my being one of the few women leaders of a university. I wouldn't be in this position had it not been for the sacrifices made by hundreds of others throughout those years. And our democracy was really hard fought for. We have a fine set of democratic institutions in this country. And I think we should not take that lightly. We must use those institutions to further our causes, whatever those causes might be. We have a lot of freedoms that should be exercised. So I encourage everybody to use it. You know, we have a Human Rights Commission, a Gender Commission, all of those so-called Chapter 9 institutions are there to further our democratic aims. So that's really one of the things that I think we must reflect on. How do we use those institutions effectively to foster the democracy that we have?
To go back quickly to student protests, to students, to ideology, to all of this stuff, and you mentioned earlier that to you it's important that that line is never crossed between peaceful protest and violence. But it has been in other campuses more than yours. We've all got very reasonable and rational concerns about how that will be resolved. Perhaps in part it has been, but in other ways it's still a looming problem. What about when it comes to free expression?
Yes.
On university campuses, what about what's going on? Even in America, they talk about this all the time, this idea of safe spaces, this idea of the ideological left actively working to silence anyone who doesn't have the same opinion as them.
Mm-hmm.
And this thought that because there are people in the arts, for example, who lean a certain way politically, that the arts are underrepresented and that the sciences are overrepresented on the political spectrum in certain places. Do you have a feeling for what I'm getting at here?
I think so, but let me check.
I'm not very clear on the question.
Well, you know, if I look at humanities disciplines, and
That's where you're from.
Psychology is my
sure.
discipline. If we take the whole cluster of social sciences, the arts, you know, one of the purposes of education in that cluster of disciplines is about intellectual inquiry, social critique. And that's very important because out of that set of disciplines or that education, political sciences, sociology, and the like, we have produced many great thinkers throughout human history. And having people on the left, or let's say on the extreme right or left, is part of what makes for a robust university environment.
But when they shut each other down,
that's where,
you know, and
that's where we one of the challenges I have as a university leader is how to create a space for open debate where everybody feels they can put their hand up or express their view. And it's not an easy thing because, as I'm sure you're familiar with, when does a view become hate speech? Now, there is a key difference with universities, though, and it's something that we have to think very importantly about. We have, you know, from the late 20th century into now, this notion that all opinions matter equally, and that might be right. But what a university education is meant to do was actually train us to think rationally.
And critically,
but to present an argument and to make your case in a systematic way.
Rigorously tear it apart on a factual, evidence-based basis.
Well, you know, and in some areas, people might question what is evidence. You know, if you come from, let's say, the arts, but anyway, we're meant to produce graduates who can think systematically about life in general, and to present their case. As you know, if you put a business proposal together, you've got to make your case.
Yeah, sure.
That's what we mean to do.
Sure.
So it's not just about a kind of a free for all.
No, sure. You said earlier we've got this idea that all opinions are equal. Well, they are at the start, but in the end, you should be able to weigh them according to their credibility.
We have to think about credibility, and it's in fact one of the challenges about, you know, the internet and social media. You know, I've watched how the media has changed. So somebody puts a tweet out there and it becomes news.
Even if it's not true.
Even if it's not true.
And it can do huge damage.
And it does huge damage. We've seen that recently in South Africa. And somebody thinks they, you know, expressing a private view, and but it's public.
Yeah.
So again, one of the challenges for us is to think about how the platforms we use and how we use those. And with freedom comes a sense of responsibility. And but again, you know, those are what we typically refer to as gray areas. So they're constantly tested. It's the nature of it.
Do you have a kind of a social media policy? Because that was also quite innovative that your university did as opposed to the others. As you said, well, if you put things out that are insightful on social media and you're a student of the University of Pretoria, we're going to have to look at whether or not we want you as a part of our institution. Because if you're inciting in words, it's as bad as doing it in person.
Well, you know, at the time we did it...
You got criticized for that.
Very heavily criticized, particularly in the media. But we got one of the best academic legal minds to assist us with that. But, you know, this is an area where life has become very interesting because technology is moving faster than the law. And, of course, human behavior always tests the law. But the law is lagging. And, you know, we now have started, or some years ago, we started a whole new area of specialization in law, looking at the impact of technology and where it's likely to take us. Let me give you an example I'm dealing with currently. So it's registration time.
Yeah.
For a number of years now, we're doing online registration. And I've challenged my colleagues about why do people still need to come to the university if we're doing everything online? You've got EFTs and all the like to make your payments. And I've been told by the legal department in the university that we actually have to have hard copies of the contracts that get signed. Now, that, of course, means that you physically have to get it to us in a commission of oaths and all of that. But it's very interesting because depending upon where you are, and even in South Africa with my bank that I use, they have given me occasion where I could simply insert my signature electronically.
Yeah.
But then, you know, do we have the necessary protocols?
There's an app on my phone I can insert my signature into things.
So, you know, the law, what we understand is contractual law is being, there are lots of room for innovation there. But, you know, it's an interesting time. So I've challenged them and I said, go back to the experts and find out if there's another way we can do it. Why should we have to queue?
So what kind of a day-to-day set of tasks do you have to perform? What does your usual day in the middle of the academic year consist of?
Oh, it's wonderfully varied, and that's partly why I enjoy it, despite, you know, the difficulties I had in 2016. It varies from speaking to students about anything. Sometimes, you know, we have many political societies who are unhappy about something or another. And I must say, often what they bring to me leads to innovation in the university. They question something and we fundamentally have to rethink it.
But there are also a lot of people who come to university. Again, I apologize for interrupting, but I you know, you're very diplomatic about this. Some people are just raised very badly, and and they just are. They want a mommy and a daddy, and sometimes it's your job as the university in their minds to provide them with a home away from home. And you've got hostels, you've got residences at the university, and I think that they start to think of you almost as surrogate parents some of the time.
Well,
and that's not your job.
Let's talk about that, because it's one of those. I'm tempted to give that.
They want a meeting with the rector. I couldn't get a meeting with the rector if I wanted one when I was there. Oh, love me, mommy. Come on.
Well, it's one of those. I want to give you that typical South African answer, yawn, yeah. Yeah. On the one hand, I am kind of a parental figure. I've got, you know, 40 close to 50,000 young people there, many of them who live in Hatfield, either in university residence or associated. And a parent who might be somewhere kilometers away on the south coast of KZN who wants to know, is their child really doing what they say they're doing? And we should find out. Yeah. And but it also shaped my thinking last year. You know, if a group of students are throwing rocks and it hits somebody's head, how do I explain to the parents? What action do I take to make sure, or at least make sure that their children are safe?
Yeah.
Now, I put myself in their shoes and I think, well, if I was the mother of this child, what would I expecting of the vice chancellor of the university?
but a lot of these parents, the reason that other children are throwing rocks is because they weren't raised properly by those parents.
Well, there's a big South African issue around what's going on in our domestic. As we know, if we look at the crime stats, a high proportion of murders are actually within
domestic,
the home.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And most of the horrible things that we hear about in society are happening within families, not outside of the families. And I think a lot of our gender issues are based on bad home situations that are never resolved.
Well,
where men are not present or where men have abdicated their responsibilities.
Let me give you a figure. We had run a student counseling center, as you know. 2 years ago, I got the audited figures, 19,000 students were seen, not for educational counseling, most of whom were seen because in that time when you transition from you're dealing with transition from high school into university, from adolescence into adulthood, and stuff that happens to you early in your years suddenly starts
bubbling over,
and all sorts of issues, history of incest, abuse.
No, we've got a very broken society on some levels.
And we really need to think about, you know, what is the moral fabric of our society. I know I sound like an old tunny now.
No, you're absolutely right. And by the way, a lot of the research, I was talking to Franz Kronier from the Institute of Race Relations yesterday.
Yeah.
A lot of the research that's been done on this particular problem, this thing that bedevils our society, you know, whether it's abuse, domestic
violence,
absent fathers, incest, all of this stuff, it doesn't have its home in poor families only.
It's across the spectrum.
In rich families, and it's across all races.
Yeah.
So it's a deep-seated problem we need to address.
I agree. You know, long before I got into this position, I always think that one of the responsibilities most people have is parenting, where you have absolutely no training.
But as a psychology graduate, that must fascinate you too.
Oh, it really does. Yeah. And, you know, I refer to absent fathers. If we look at the crime figures and the research that's been done on young men in prison, more than half of them had no meaningful relationship with their father figure, and a significant number do not know who their fathers are. Now, if we think about masculinity at that time in one's life, and specifically the kind of expectations society has of young men, it's really very complex. And that the gender issue is becoming much more complex than before, because if we look at universities, we now have a higher number of women students than men, and women students on average as a group do better academically than men.
Absolutely. This is the uncomfortable stuff that people don't want to talk about because it's not politically correct or always politically useful, depending on your ideology.
Well, I think we have to look at it.
I mean, there's also the fact that's uncomfortable for a lot of people, that women in general aren't applying to the sciences in the numbers that men do, or to engineering.
Well, again, it's changed significantly. If we look at chemical engineering, I don't have the statistics I can quote you, but I think it's almost at parity.
Really?
Yes.
That's
but
very,
very
interesting.
But if we then go to some of the other disciplines in engineering, like mechanical, electrical, that's where we're
still
not...
Still very male biased.
It's still very male biased.
Well, it's male interest. I mean, again, you know, the dangerous jobs are the ones that men often go for as well. So you end up with men doing things where there is danger pay on oil rigs and, you know, the North Sea. This is the kind of thing that's not going to change.
I have a different view. I think many of us women are risk-taking individuals and we're adventurous. We simply have to start rethinking the messages we give to young girls about career options.
Perhaps.
You know, if I look at mountaineering and all of that, there are certain things women are involved in it.
There are certain areas that you've got to say, look, there's more of an interest by men and women in this regard.
Well, I think, Gareth, you know, that's something I'm also a bit critical of, because our interests get...
Don't be polite with me. You can say I'm talking rubbish.
Our interests get shaped from when we were young. You know, I remember I was encouraged to be a teacher, a nurse, and then, you know, people saying, don't be a nurse, you've got to work night shift, think you're going to have children. Go into teaching, you can look after the children after school. So it's about the messaging that shapes our interest as girls. I have a little one who I'm in contact with, and I've been watching children's programs and looking at the messaging there. I mean, I was quite pleased to see there are now women or girls who are action heroes, unlike a few years ago.
And you've got, you know, you've got gay characters now and all kinds of things. So it's starting to come right.
Because that shapes our interest.
I absolutely agree with you. But the research bears out the fact that there are certain professions that are more attractive to men and certain professions that are more attractive to women on the whole. I'm not saying that should be a rule.
Yeah.
Anyone should be able to do whatever they want in an ideal world. But certainly, and perhaps it's because of social norms, because it's messaging and because
it's socialization in general.
Yeah, sure, all of that stuff comes into it. But, you know, the fact that engineering has been so male-dominated for so long is not because men have tried to keep women out of engineering. There are just not as many women applying to be engineers as there are women applying to be other things.
Yeah, but, you know, we have to, as I said, think about that. Let's take the typical construction site. Are there facilities for women on construction sites?
No.
Yeah, my point taken, I hope.
But that doesn't prove that women all want to, they're desperate to be in construction, but they just, couldn't find a bathroom.
Yeah.
You know? I don't think, a woman who wants to be on a construction site probably would use whichever bathrooms are available anyway.
I use that as an example.
I don't know a lot of women who are in construction, but I would imagine if they are, they're not really fussed where the bathroom is. They'll use whichever one they want.
I think it's about increasing the opportunities.
Yeah. All right. No, look, I'm not going to get into a debate with you. You're the boss here. You're the rector of the university.
I'm not looking for a fight.
No. Look, I would be fascinated to know about the things that you guys are doing that you're very proud of at the moment, the things that you're doing in terms of innovation, the things you said earlier about relevance that make you different and set you apart from the other universities, and where you get a lot of the ideas from. You've mentioned students who give you ideas. Mm. You probably have some very, very smart people within the faculty who are able to come up with great new ideas. But where are you really passionate in terms of innovation at the moment?
At the moment, well, there are a whole range of issues. You know, I referred to relevance earlier on. And for me, quality and relevance are part of the same issue.
Mm.
Because what was considered quality 100 years ago is not anymore. Yeah. What's a quality graduate? So one of the things I'm really passionate about is understanding what's changing in the world. And for that reason, we have started systematically measuring the success of our graduates, or keeping track of the success of graduates in the broader economy. Because for me, if I put myself in the shoes of a parent who still has to pay tuition fees, I would say, well, you know, let me choose the university where the uptake after graduation in the marketplace or the success rate is best.
Right. Parents want a return on their investment.
Absolutely. And, you know, after you graduate, do you necessarily want to just, you know, sit around for a while? You want to know there's an opportunity out there for you. So for me, that's a good measure of quality. You won't employ anybody who doesn't meet the requirements of your business or your organization. For me, that's critically important.
And how is the University of Pretoria stacking up in that regard?
Absolutely, very good. The last survey we did showed to us that over 90% of the students within 6 months had secured an opportunity that they sought.
That's pretty good.
In some disciplines, it's much higher. In others, it takes a bit longer. So I'm giving you an average.
Pit them against each other. Which departments do better?
Engineering.
Yeah.
You're
the top engineering school in the country, right?
We are. Yeah. Accounting. Almost all of them have jobs by the time they graduate.
I remember those engineering students were the most boring people I've ever met in my life. I was studying law, and we thought we were very smart and interesting by comparison.
Well, the law graduates do very well. What I've really been amazed about is how many graduates from law, for example, end up doing something that is not really what they expected to do.
It's because they're nice people. Only the horrible ones become lawyers. but that's also good.
But
faculty.
Back to innovation. The other area where I think we're at the front end is innovation in teaching.
Yeah.
Last year with all the disruptions due to protest, we were able to mix our contact and online or to switch a lot faster than some other universities, because we some years ago decided that we would invest in online teaching technology. It's been a huge investment financially, but I think we now have an opportunity to revolutionize what we offer and to make it more accessible to more people.
And it's a great income stream for the university.
Well, not yet.
It will be.
Hopefully in the future, because the upfront costs are high, as well as the ongoing costs, because much of the technology is licensed and needs upgrading every year. Mm. Technology changes a lot, and it's not cheap, of course.
What about language? Because this always comes up when you talk about the University of Pretoria. When people find out that I studied there, they're surprised. Some of them have a look of horror on their face when I tell them I did all my classes in English.
Yes, you see,
there's a legacy thing going on there.
But I discovered in the process of the debate about language policy that many people were under the assumption that we were offering everything in Afrikaans with some in English, which is quite the opposite. Everything, ever since I started there, is offered in English, with some being offered in Afrikaans as well.
Right. But they think Universiteit van Pretoria, alles is in Afrikaans.
Well, that stopped from the early 90s.
But then you get shit from the other side.
Yes.
Because now you get Afrikaans people who will say to you, ach, this university is going backwards, this nie die universiteit wat ek, waarvan ek gehou het, the mensen wat het gestig het, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous. It's kind of like everybody brings their own agendas, and the students end up being caught up, sometimes unwillingly, in a debate that isn't even theirs. They're there to learn.
Well, it's an important debate, because it's part of the transformation, the transition of South African society.
Mm. Now you get pressure too from people who say, well, why aren't you giving more in Setswana, for example?
Yes, it is. So if we commit ourselves to multilingualism as a principle, it's a valid question. You can't only offer in two. You've got to think multi means more than two. It's not bi. So it's a valid question. From my point of view, the issue is pragmatic. Pragmatic not only from a financial sense, but from an expertise level. If you offer a scientific course in a language other than English, the real challenge we face is the availability of learning and educational material in that language. Mm-hmm. And unless there is a homegrown capacity to develop that, and all the textbooks, the knowledge base, you're inevitably going to study it in English. And that's something that we see across the world, with more and more European universities now offering all their postgraduate programs in English, for example, because English is becoming a kind of global business language. And we see it in Asia as well.
I don't think anyone's going to disagree with you, but that doesn't stop people from making their problems yours. And by saying, you know, well, I'd like to do a PhD in Setswana.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you will obviously try to accommodate where you can.
Where we can and where there's the available expertise, as I indicated.
You know, it's a horrible job, actually. I don't know why you're doing it. You're mad. You could be a very happy, self-actualized human being with very little to concern yourself if you didn't have this awful job.
Oh, wow.
Is your office still in that hideous building right on the corner of Linwood? And
yes, it's still in the same building.
God, it's an awful looking
known
building.
Known as the ship.
Yeah, it's such an ugly building.
You know, I suspect from an...
Whoever, in the architecture, there's something about the 70s and 80s that we need to do atonement for, because the University of Pretoria in particular, with that Weitzbeen Gebouw over the road that is now at the entrance, and your building, some hideous architecture.
Well, let me tell you what you may have missed. The University of Pretoria on the Hatfield campus has got an eclectic set of buildings architecturally, which is a fine representation of architecture in South Africa from the beginning of the 20th century. So I can take you through and say this represents
sure.
The 1920s.
That old building in the middle?
The old arts building.
That's the one. But my God, some of it is just, you could say eclectic, I'll say revolting.
Well, you're talking about some specific buildings.
Yeah, your one that your office is in particular. And well, it was when I went up there once, it was all wood paneled and dark on the inside. Is it still like that?
No, not at all. I must invite you to my office.
Okay, Well, listen, the University of Pretoria and many of our South African universities are places that we are rightly very proud of. The kinds of things that you're doing there, the innovations that you're trying to push forward, the students that you're churning out that are going out there into the world and changing things, these are things we should all be very, very happy about and concerned with when they don't work.
Rightly so.
But well done to you, and congratulations on navigating that very tough year of 2016.
Yes.
I hope.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure. And I'm holding thumbs for you that 2017 is a lot easier. And that the only challenges you have are the ones that occupy your mind about where to put extra money, where to invest new ideas, and where to grow.
Well, you know, I would be happy if 2017 is a year without the disruption we had last year, and we have peaceful engagement.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much, Prof.
Thank you.
Professor Cheryl Delaray, the Rector and Vice-Chancellor of the University of Pretoria. CliffCentral.com.